Hi, and welcome to Revision Media with me here, Paul Stevenson, live from London for the next hour. This is Wednesday, the 27th of January, 2021. It feels to me it's been a very long January. I think the weather it hasn't helped. The long, dark evenings start to get to you at this stage. You kind of had enough. It's a bit like everything else, isn't it? It's a bit like the lockdowns and masks and stuff. It just seems to drag on and kind of wears you down a little bit. But yeah, January's almost over. So it is comforting that and encouraging that, you know, the evenings, you can feel that you can see there's more daylight in the evening. So, and, you know, things change very quickly. Before you know it, you'll be into March. And I think the clocks change at the end of March, don't they? But yeah, while we can be guaranteed that the daylight and the weather will probably change, but we can be guaranteed that the daylight hours and the all that will change, there doesn't seem to be many guarantees when it comes to these lockdowns. Earlier in the week, it's just like, and Matt Hancock and Boris Johnson, the little Marxist globalist puppets, are using language like we're a long, long way off and we're not out of this by a long way, this type of language. And of course, we've reached this, they keep calling this grim milestone of 100,000 deaths over here. And Boris Johnson standing up there saying, oh, you know, I take the buck stops with me and I'm sorry for every single death. Well, It's not really any one man's fault, is it, for 100,000 deaths for a start? So it's a bit pathetic. What you should be sorry for is what you're really up to, which is using a virus and colluding with the media to pump out your propaganda to restructure society for your employers. That's what you should be sorry about. There's a lot more people wise to this nonsense than there would have been, say, 18 years ago when they took us to war in Iraq illegally. But yeah, that's what you should be sorry for: wrecking the economy, destroying businesses, destroying people's hopes, destroying kids' future, turning the UK into a second world country, if we're lucky, by the time this is all finished, for deflecting and suppressing and smearing any dissenting voices to your official mainstream narrative. There's a lot you should be sorry for, Boris, but the 100,000 deaths, which are not 100,000 at all, is what you should be sorry about. 100,000 deaths from coronavirus, they tell us. Yeah. On talk radio, at least, when they announced these figures, they announced it, as I say, talk radio is a kind of it's the best you're going to get in terms of like mainstream media. It's like centrist sort of types. They correctly announced on their news program that it was 100,000 deaths of people who had coronavirus on their death certificates, which is a more accurate way of describing it. Because there's a hell of a lot of those people on that 100,000 that died of plenty of other things apart from coronavirus. And the significant difference is dying of coronavirus as opposed to dying with coronavirus as opposed to dying of coronavirus. The BBC themselves, when they announce these figures, have it at the bottom. These are deaths from anyone who has tested positive has a positive test for coronavirus within 28 days. So this 100,000 includes anybody who died from anything within 28 days after having a positive test. In other words, someone who died of cancer, and they may have had cancer for the last 3 years, and died of cancer 3 weeks after they had a positive test for coronavirus, that goes on there. It also robs the families of a true identification of their death. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had a family member, God forbid, or someone I loved who died from, you know, a heart attack or heart disease or cancer or dementia or even flu, and the NHS had the audacity to put that down as a death from coronavirus, I would feel outraged, actually. And I'm wondering if they, why more people haven't come forward to say, maybe they have, but they're not going to get a voice. They're probably out there just suffering as well, saying, no, I don't want that in the death certificate. And I forget who it was today. I wish I had it done, but I was on the way to work when I was listening to him, and I didn't quite catch his name. But there was a guy on talk radio this morning, and he said, there is tremendous symmetry between the deaths and the, you know, the large number of deaths from coronavirus and the unprecedented low number of deaths from flu, dementia, and other conditions that would normally be much higher every year. There is so much propaganda. There is so much manipulation of the figures, and you're not allowed to talk about it, conspiracy theorist, disinformation, misinformation artist. And then we have Joe Biden. Oh, it's painful, isn't it? As I say, you know that the weather or the daylight, that's going to change. But the lockdowns, the masks, they'll never let us not wear masks. And Joe Biden, we got him for 4 years. Joe Biden, yeah, it's a battle on for soul of America. The battle on for soul of America. Can't quite get the words out, Joe. And it's like a kind of a, it's like, I'm not really sure whether Joe's actually real. Anybody out there agree? Is Joe real? Is he a robot? Bit of AI going on there. It's a battle on for soul of America. Doesn't really quite get the words out, really, does he? It's like, you know, give that, you know, like you can they must give him injections or something, you know. But I think possibly he's a robot. You know, you sort of expect sort of like the wire and start to go, you know, like the Terminator, you know, and you know, whenever the wiring goes, there's like a short circuit. You kind of feel Joe just might just blow up one day and just like, you know, go on fire. It's battle on for the soul of America. Battle on for the soul of America. Oh, yeah, Joe, there is a battle on for the soul of America because of clowns like you. You're part of a fifth column trying to destroy it. I mean, oh, God, it's hard to listen to, isn't it? I mean, you know, these people and unity, you know, they talk about, we got to unite America. And basically what that means is, you know, you got to repent of your dissent, you evil Trump supporters, and anybody who doesn't support our abomination policies and ideologies. That's what unity means to these people. I mean, some of them, I think, are so full of BS. I think they at least when they're up there, they actually believe it. But, I mean, they're good actors, aren't they? That's what a hypocrite is, an actor. That's what the word means. It comes from the Greek word, Hippocrates. It means that it's in those days, it was just known as an actor, you know, in the theater. And that's what they are, aren't they? The actors. You know, that Chuck Schumer. You know, you get these polls you do, or these, like, you know, top five best footballers of all time, you know, top best boxers of all time, you know, and it's like a kind of, you know, it's football, it's always a close run, you know, you can ask any number of people and it'd be like, oh, Pelé's definitely number one, Maradona number two, Johan Cruyff number three, Messi, you know, four, Ronaldo five, and then you'd ask someone else, it'd be, no, Messi's number one, Maradona two, Pelé three, blah, 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 blah. same way boxers would be like, no, Sugar Ray Robinson number one, then Joe, you know, then Muhammad Ali number two, Joe Lewis number three, and ask someone else. You know, it's always a close run thing. You're talking about, you know, I even hate to use this analogy because this is like, you know, a fun, enjoyable thing of like admirable people for the most part, and you know, for where I'm going with this. But you know, do you ever like? I wonder if you could do, you know, have a similar thing. Who is like the worst politician? Whose face, whose voice do you hate the most? You know. Over here, we've got like, you know, I was sitting thinking about this the other day, and I came up with like number one and number two is a close run between Sadiq Khan, one of the most arrogant and unjustifiably arrogant, inarticulate, uncharismatic, devoid of any charisma, little weasels of all time, Sadiq Khan. Nicola Sturgeon. Boris Johnson, Matt Hancock. I mean, this guy, Matt Hancock, he looks like, I don't know. He's a psychopath. I mean, the way this guy just sort of looks at the screen and he's like, I haven't got the vocabulary to describe what it is I feel about this guy. He's like, he's just a total psycho. You can imagine him just like making people's life a misery and just like, you know, being an absolute horrible piece of crap to his staff, to his family, you know, to anybody who got on the wrong side of him. You know, he's just a little psycho, probably homosexual as well, I would imagine, like a lot of them. Keir Starmer, the little Trotskyite Keir Starmer, who tries to act like, you know, he's got the human touch. He's down with the working class. You see him on the radio and stuff. It's so trans, you know, and he's talking to people, you know, and someone will call in and he's like, it's so transparent. Just drop the facade, Keir. We know you're just another globalist little Marxist puppet politician. Give it a rest. I mean, these people, they come out, they try everything, don't they, to get into power. And then when they eventually do get into power, then they just do their own thing. Then they do what they really want to do. Then they just carry out their own agenda. It's just, screw you, I'm in power now, and I'm going to do what I want. That's what they do all the time. But anyway, who else have you got? Over in America, I came up with it. It's got to be, despite it's a very, very close run thing, it's got to be Sadiq Khan, particularly, you know, because these people, and the cabinet's full of them, these foreigners, these immigrants who came over here in the 70s, it shouldn't be allowed. It's not their culture. They're not invested in the culture. They're not invested in maintaining our culture or our heritage. And yet they end up in these powerful positions where they can direct and do just that, embodied in Sadiq Khan, who has the audacity to try and destroy the black cabs, a cultural symbol of London. You know, his parents arrived here from Pakistan in the 70s. How can it be the putrid offspring of those people end up in the mayor of London? They have less than half a century presence here. Priti Patel, the Home Secretary, came to talk about, you know, the drunk looking after the liquor store. I mean, they're everywhere. So, number one spot goes to Sadiq Khan for all the reasons I mentioned. At least Nicola Sturgeon is Scottish. I don't know. Maybe that makes it worse. I don't know. They're all a bunch of words I won't say here in this show. You go and pop over across the pond there. Who have you got? You know, Nancy Pelosi. She's in the mix. Chuck Schumer's in the mix. Who else have you got? Lindsey Graham. Who else? Biden, of course. Kamala Harris. Hillary Clinton, but she's no longer in power. We'll give it to Chuck Schumer because he's a sneaky Jew. And another total hypocrite. Anyway, rant over. What I was intending to do tonight, I was intending to actually go through an article. and global research. But I'm going to play a clip by a guy called Doug Casey and a guest that they have on, a guy called John Robb. This is really interesting. This guy, his background is in counterterrorism in the Middle East. And he gives some tremendous insights here as to what's happening and using parallels of counterinsurgency and counterterrorism in the Middle East, how they manipulate the situation and how that has been now brought back to America domestically to deal with basically dissenters. White people that they call white supremacy, basically white European America, and anybody who signs on to that and is involved with the – it's not just white people, but anybody – I mean, they are that. That's what their core hatred is. But anybody that is part of the Trump movement and the populist movement, those guilty of insurrection a couple of weeks ago. So this guy's John Robb, and it's on Doug Casey's take. Doug Casey's a very interesting guy as well, very easy to listen to and edifying. He's an economist, but we're not going to get to play all of it because it's an hour and 2 minutes long, but this is really, really fascinating, I thought. And it really does sort of encapsulate a lot of the ideas that we've been speaking about over the last few months, but with some other stuff that I hadn't really thought about because I don't have his expertise. So I think this really has value. And his name is John Robb.
All right, good morning, everybody. I'm here with Doug Casey and a friend of ours, John Robb. If you're not familiar with John's work, you will really get a kick out of today's episode because John is one of the most unique thinkers out there today. He has a special operations background, worked and planned counterterrorism missions. He was an entrepreneur in technology, an analyst in technology, but he's most famous for his thinking about warfare. And you'll hear a little bit about that today, but he has a Patreon account. I definitely encourage everybody to go and subscribe to it. It's completely worth it. He's thinking about things literally years ahead of anyone else. Sometimes when you read it, it'll seem crazy, and then you go back 3 years later and be like, this is exactly what he predicted. So with that, John, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate you being here. So I have a whole bunch of things I want to talk to you about, but I wonder if you could give first people a framework for the way you think about the world.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's a big framework. Okay, so I'm writing mostly today about the intersection of technology, warfare, and politics. And my focus has been on how social networking is rewiring us, rewiring our brains in a McLuhan sense. We're thinking differently. We're moving from reading in isolation and forming an opinion like driven by the printing press to pattern matching. And pattern matching affects the way we think as individuals as well as how we interact with the world. We have a fast flow of information going by, and we just pick out the little bits that make sense to us. We fit it into the patterns, and then we join with others to curate big patterns. That curation has created network tribes that have a level of cohesion you see in a standard tribal framework. On the left, we've seen most of the action in forming those tribes. We see the anti-racists, the anti-fascists, they aren't forming tribes based on patterns or narratives that are positive. They have formed tribes based on the idea that there's a pattern of behavior of people they hate, and they can all agree on that. They can't agree on what justice is or anything positive or any kind of single narrative because all of their value frameworks are subjectively derived. So what they can't agree on is who they hate. And they build these tribes through what I call the empathy triggers. Empathy, as I dug into the neuroscience of it, is really kind of a pre-verbal communication system. It allows you to transfer a mental model through stories or through actions directly to another person, and they mimic it. They model it themselves based on those cues. They fill in the blanks. I mean, when somebody gets hit and they are injured, you feel that injury, you grimace, or when you have a video of George Floyd with a knee on his neck, you feel that knee on your neck, you get mad, you get angry. That works really, really well in social networking. And it's used to create that kind of selective empathy that you have in warfare and in tribal warfare, where you get 100% of the empathy for the people inside the tribe and zero for the people outside. Negative, actually, because it doesn't really matter what happens to them. They're enemies. Anything they say or do is, you know, an attack. And anything that happens to them is well-deserved. So another framework I have is – oh, yeah, go ahead.
That's a good place to, that's a good place to start. I want to talk about networking in general and how everything is through a network now also. But, one of the things that I think you hear people on the right often say is they're trying to constantly compare. This standard applies to them, and they're trying to get people in this hypocrisy trap. But like, as I noticed a couple of years ago, and I think off of something you said in one of your newsletters, that didn't work anymore. Like, because they're distinct tribes, that it's all totally fruitless. You're only talking to your own tribe, essentially, when you're even pointing it out.
Right. It's an asymmetric conflict. You can't, the same rules don't apply. There's no common ground, any harm that you experience is not going to be experienced by the people on the other side. Remember Apocalypse Now, where, you know, Colonel Kurtz is kind of going, if I only had these soldiers that would operate like these tribesmen, you know, they would go out and do horrific things all day, and they'd come home into their families and kiss their kids on the head, and they'd go to sleep like babies. But he couldn't get that because people had that common ground between people that we have in modern society, and it doesn't exist as in the tribal framework. The people outside the tribe are human. When you hear, what does this tribe call itself? It usually calls itself the people or the humans. You know, it's like everyone outside of that is not. So anything you do to them, it really doesn't matter. It won't have a negative impact on your emotional frameworks. So we're getting that kind of selective empathy that we would only see in wartime, in peacetime. Somehow we created it. We're allowing it to continue.
Yeah. How do you define the difference between the rightists and the leftists? Why do people fall into one general category or the other? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and one of the things I find about, I've seen network decision-making as a new decision-making, social decision-making system. We had, markets, we had traditional tribalism, which kind of gave us nationalism, which kind of gave us that collective identity that allowed us to trust the information that other people were giving, at least that it was not meant to hurt us. And then we had bureaucracy, which is really the cockroach of organizations, but it fueled governments, it fueled the science infrastructure, it fueled everything, it fueled corporations. Now we have this new decision-making system we haven't figured out how to deal with yet, how to actually fully bind. That social decision-making system is good at a lot of things, it's great at mobilization, but one of the ways I think it makes decisions is it's very good at consensus building, everybody thinking the same thing. And getting that information, and it's mobilizing very quickly, and it's also good at spreading dissent, and trying to pick away at arguments, and that a functional social decision-making system balances dissent and consensus building. A dysfunctional one wipes out all the dissent, and the consensus gets big and gets stuck there, and it just lasts forever. The right is basically on this poll, the dissent function, and the left is becoming the consensus function. The left is like, either you're with us or you're against us. We're going to shame you if you fall outside this framework. And the right is trying to fight. They're like kind of a collection of dissenters on everything. And they are picking apart the arguments and trying to show that that consensus is wrong, or it's outlived its usefulness, or it needs to be reversed. So it's like a different kind of political spectrum, consensus, dissent, at least within the network world. Does that make sense? Or?
why would somebody fall into the left as the right? Is it a psychological thing, or is it because they were indoctrinated earlier in life, or what makes the difference between a rightist and a leftist joining one crew as opposed to the other?
Yeah, I haven't really figured out what the driver is, what the key indicator is. People on the left in the consensus group tend to be comforted by, you know, having people around them saying the same thing. And comfort in numbers. They tend to get, you know, very hysterical if people don't agree with them. And that there is, you know, the existence of this dissent out there. It's largely, you know, the way you see the world, I guess. I don't have a very unique answer for this yet. Dissent is still people who are seeing flaws in the system. They see a need to, you know, pick at the consensus. They, you know, we saw this in COVID, where we had a consensus for a very short period of time, and then because it wasn't acted upon or wasn't put in place, the dissent started picking away at it. I don't have a neat answer for that yet. But that was a good question. So if I don't have a neat answer, that means it's a great question.
John, one of the things that you mentioned in a recent newsletter was that there was this emerging pattern on the right that could lead to a real lasting tribalism on the right that maybe didn't exist on the left so far. And this is this pattern of conspiracy where, you know, it almost is like the same consensus building pattern that you might have with like anti-racism or, you know, those on the left, but this emerging pattern on the right of conspiracy. Can you talk about what that looks like to you?
Yeah. You know, the whole Trump phenomenon was largely, from my perspective, dissent, and Trump was put into place to stir things up. And from his method of operation, he was perfect for that. I mean, he moved fast transients from one topic to the next, to disruption, constantly disrupting. And as long as he was continuing to disrupt the system from locking down, from that consensus, from locking everything down, he was supported. But his support base was all over the map. It didn't have a common thread that tied it all together, other than they didn't like the existing system. And as long as he was disrupting, he, you know, fulfilled what I call the plausible promise of the kind of open source movement behind him. The problem was that it's tough to keep an open source movement if, you know, it is, you know, removed from power or achieves its objective. And, you know, with Trump expecting deplatforming, what happened was that they moved into conspiracy frameworks in order to kind of provide that kind of pattern cohesion, a pattern like the left of things they hate or this opposition, this existential evil. And the problem with that was a fork in the insurgency. It just was a hard fork, kind of very similar to what happened with the Al-Qaeda in Iraq in 2007 when they attacked the Golden Mosque. You know, they were fighting the Americans, and then Al-Qaeda decided that, oh yeah, we're going to, you know, expand this into a religious war with the Shia, and they attacked the Golden Mosque, and all of a sudden there was these massive militias moving through Baghdad doing ethnic cleansing, and every time the Sunni insurgency tried to form something large enough to fight them, they were pounded by the Americans from above, right? And so they were caught in this, like, pincher, which caused them to negotiate. So forks are potentially dangerous. That, you know, I had written about the idea that if once you have a hard fork like that, it goes towards confrontation. And most of those folks on the Capitol event were all conspiracists. Watch the videos of them inside of the Capitol. They were almost LARPing. You know, it's like a live action role playing where they were looking for evidence on the deaths of the different congressmen for, you know, proof that the election was rigged. Cruz was going to actually do it. It was just wild. I was watching him go through everybody's documents. But that event was seen as an attack and seen as violence, extreme violence, even though it was unarmed and, you know, it was deadly, granted, but it was an unarmed riot. And that, as I anticipated, would cause an extreme overreaction that the establishment would then launch counterterrorism, they would launch Patriot Act 2.0. They would start to hunt down people attached to the event and then expand that into a hunt for every group that potentially is a dissent to the establishment. And that eventually we get into this counterinsurgency where you have these fundamentalists, which are these enemies who are all the people who have a reason to dissent from the establishment view, seen as enemies and people that need to be deprogrammed. And it creates this insurgency where there wasn't one. So it's these, you know, small groups are all mostly scattered and mostly nonviolent. And you start putting pressure on them. You start to do no-knock raids, and you start to disappear them. You start to go after their families and surveil them. And you start to create this real thing. And it rolled out that way. It's looking exactly like that pattern.
Yeah, it kind of seems that way to me, too.
Yep.
Do we know for a fact that there was a lot of infiltration by Antifa and BLM in this, you know, very mild riot? It's not even the right word to call it, I think. It was just a bunch of Republicans that were unhappy, more than a riot. But was there a lot of infiltration, do you think?
A little bit. I mean, there was infiltration last year in the BLM riots by guys on the right, different right groups and different individuals. So, I mean, everybody who wanted to accelerate things, everyone who wants this, you know, to become a violent conflict in the United States, or shows up. It's just a matter of course. But there were so many different little groups and individual actors. It's really hard to determine, you know, differentiate. I don't think it was predominantly Antifa or BLM infiltrators. You know, there's onesies and twosies. It was a mess. I was watching it in live streams. I had three different live streams going, and I was watching from different angles in the Capitol. And, you know, it was just chaotic. There was no rhyme or reason. There was no plan. It just happened.
It just seems like there's a spirit abroad in the land where a lot of people want to immanentize the eschaton. They want to get it on. In other words, they've defined the enemy, and they're looking for a fight. I mean, on both sides at this point. So that's the only comment. Do you see it that way too, or is that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, there's lots of people who want it. Unfortunately, right now for the right, the dissent function is that it's caught with three enemies. It's got the establishment, the traditional neoliberal establishment, you know, represented in the government and a lot of corporations, and they're pretty hollow. I mean, you know, they can't really do anything domestically in terms of programs or anything like that, or even any kind of reforms. What they can do is, like, push the button on counterterrorism and warfare. They are going back, trying to roll back the clock to this kind of hyper-normal, everything is placid, everything is great kind of world of Obama and Bush and Clinton. And then you have the big corporations, the network corporations, who proved, you know, decisively that they can control the flank, the online flank of the establishment. I mean, they took out, when they banned Trump as a seated president, they proved that they could take out the most powerful person in the world without repercussion. I mean, ban them from social networking, which is, you know, a huge part of the media consumption that people consume worldwide. Facebook, for instance, has 3.5 billion users, and that's where people get the majority of their news overseas. Then you have the tribal left, and the tribal left is going out there and doing this open source shaming system where they're finding all the pictures of all the people who ever say anything against or who turned up at the riot in particular. They have, you know, just identified all, you know, 6,000 unique images. They're taking out the police images, and then they are going to permanentize the loss of jobs, the loss of status, I fully expect it to probably get folded into the blockchain or a blockchain at some point. It can, you know, keep that shaming function going forever. So they are all together. And the dissent, the right, is all by itself. It's really outgunned at this point. I don't see a happy future where there's a balance between the two.
Where does Antifa fit into this? Because there's a, you know, yesterday during the inauguration, they had different protests at different state capitals, for instance.
Right.
And it seems like, you know, they were in alignment at one point with the left, but it seems like, you know, they might be this other force that's kind of breaking away. What do you think about that?
Yeah, they're doing something that's going to get them put into the dissent fund, you know, dissent group. And they'll end up getting swept up with the counterterrorism, counterinsurgency effort that's building. In fact, they were already. I was watching a lot of people in the Antifa world talking about people getting rounded up already. So it's already as they're rounding up people on the right that associated with the Capitol event, even you know 1 degree off the Capitol event or one layer off. People who supported it, they're doing the same thing on the left with Antifa. They won't touch BLM, but they'll go after them. And if you go out and riot in this environment, man, you're basically putting a target on your head. This is not easy stuff.
What does Patriot Act 2.0 look like in your mind?
Well, you know, all the limitations right now on NSA and others, you know, they have a lot of limitations on what they can gather about U.S. persons, and those will be lifted for designated individuals and their networks, association networks, and anyone's associated with people who have a history of saying XYZ or posting Confederate flags and things like that, they are going to be in the threat list, in this big blacklist that drive these things, and anyone who are associated with them, and they'll be monitored. And they will be targeted, and they will be baited, as we often saw with the you know way we went after Islamic terrorism. That, you know, some mentally challenged guy will be talking you know, shit online, and then some FBI agent will then bait him with, "Hey, do you want to you know do this? I have some weapons I can sell you, or I have some bomb materials I can sell you." And the guy goes, "Oh yeah, sure." Whereas that guy on his own had no capacity to do any of this stuff, no capacity to you know, generate the materials or put them together in any useful fashion or execute an attack. So, yeah, all these folks are going to be targeted like that.
Wow, that's pretty dystopian. One of the things you talked about recently was you talked about open source secret police system. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah, that's what I was talking about in terms of getting pictures. They took that 42 gigabytes from Parler and they sifted through it, about 11 hours of really good video that came out of that, and then they went and pulled 6,000 unique or what they 6,000 images of faces, and they narrowed that down to people that they are trying to narrow it down by taking out the police images, and then it's interesting that the group that's doing this is just posting the images, so there's kind of a, like a, putting a firewall between doing that act and then what comes after. And so law enforcement will upload those and do their ID work and lots of different layers of law enforcement because everybody is going to be militarized. You know, the militarization of the police we saw after 9/11 is going to be nothing compared to what's coming, you know, in terms of militarization down to the, you know, the beat cop level. And then you have the open source version and those people will run facial recognition and they'll do a lot of hand searching and they'll find these people and you can see there's a steady stream of this where Antifa has got people that have identified from it, they know where they work, they post their names and where they work and their home address and everyone goes after them and then they start calling the work nonstop to get the person fired, they contact all the people in their contact list on Facebook. And say that they're fascists, they say that they're Nazis, they say that they're you know, white supremacists, that you should just disconnect from them. And open source version. My worry is that it even goes even farther by then putting it into the blockchain, and then it becomes forever.
What do you think about, historically, if you look at, what happened after the Russian Revolution, early Soviet days where they had these large purges, or look in the Cultural Revolution with Mao, there were these purges, these physical purges that occurred. Right. And one of the things I've been thinking a lot based upon the stuff that you've written is that maybe most of the purges actually occur in the virtual world. The vast majority of it is occurring in the virtual world, but of course it's going to intersect into physical reality in a big way at some point. What do you think about that? Where does that intersection, when does it become much more about, the real world? And I know it affects people's jobs when they're getting people fired and things like that, but right. I don't see purges where they're sending police to your door and taking you, disappearing you in the middle of the night. I mean, is that something? Well, what are your thoughts?
We're going to see that with the counterterrorism, counterinsurgency effort. That goes right into the real world from the get-go. And then the attempts on the open source side to, contact your employer and contact your friends and family, your wife, your kids. What the big corporations are doing, the big network corporations, is much more scalable. And they can see down to the conversational level and then target you. So right now they're just waiting you. They're developing a trustworthy metric and extremist metric that's being attached to your identity. What they're doing on the network side is much more scary long-term and much more permanent, is that we're finding that modern life is connected to this network world increasingly. We do everything through these networks. And then, everything from dating apps to job search to, if you're running a small business, you have to get flow through these networks. You have to advertise through them. If you want to publish, you have to go through them. You want to communicate, you have to go through them. And people, if you can't communicate, then you can't really do much. Your personhood is tied up in this digital network. And what we're finding is when they target you, they don't just kick you off maybe one big social network. It has a disconnection cascade that flows down through all the networks. So the guy, CEO running Parler, when they threw off, when Amazon Web Services disconnected Parler, it caused a cascade of disconnections. And he was saying, my email provider disconnected me. My text provider disconnected me. My lawyer left me. I mean, it was like one thing after another. It basically unpersons you. So we're having that social credit score that we're talking about in China is already being implemented. And you can be unpersoned from the modern digital world, which then your financial future is curtailed, your ability to connect with other people, if you're unmarried, to get married, goes way down. Your selection pool gets shrunk, since everybody, all the young people, are all meeting online, you're in open air prison, open air digital prison. You're locked out, and we see. I don't think people fully appreciate how much of a parallel power structure this corporate network is. I mean, we have all these controls. We have a constitution. We have a bill of rights. Everything that is constrains the power of government. Because we know that excesses of the government excesses can do horrible things. But we have nothing for this network. It's running open loop. There's no natural limiting factors. And how that rolls out is something I've been thinking a lot about. It's just like, that's bad news for not just now, but in the future.
I do know that, you think of these examples with the social media, and it's just mostly about communication and commerce. But then when I know people that have been banned from Airbnb, for instance, or been banned from Uber, or maybe even Uber Eats. So you can't leave your house now because we're on lockdown, but then you can't order food.
Right.
It can go to places that I think I didn't appreciate at first. I'm like, you get kicked off Twitter. Is that the end of the world? Probably not.
Right.
But it gets down to these really basic necessities as everything is funneled through a few key companies, especially.
And they have this parallel network, this collusion of sorts where they share the blacklists increasingly. So if you're knocked off one network, your name goes to the other networks, you know, as somebody not to be on, you know, trusted, not to be worthy of offering services to. And that's a completely unregulated thing. I mean, they've been using a lot of very partisan organizations to kind of identify which groups are dangerous. You know, and all the libertarian groups now are considered extremist organizations in the States. Even had Brennan on yesterday saying, we should treat libertarians as terrorists. I mean, it's like, along with everybody else, they're enemies of the state. It's getting crazy. I call this future an... Oh, go ahead, Doug, you have some.
No, I was agreeing with you, but I was going to add one thing. I'm of the opinion that the Bill of Rights, which is the only important part of the U.S. Constitution, really, is basically a dead letter at this point. And the fact that, there's two things that, two important things that people like are money and power. And especially since the government itself is bankrupt at this point, but you've got these multi-billionaires, but now that they've got money, they want power. And of course, it's a Mussolini-type thing, a melding of the state and the big money, the corporations. That's what's happening before Iraq. Is this going to result in a civil war?
I mean, it's an online civil war. It's kind of a virtual civil war right now. McLuhan in 1968 called it a global guerrilla information war. You know, it's like World War III will be that. We're constantly battling it out online, trying to see who would be dominant. I think it's pretty lopsided and one-sided at this point between the establishment and his counterterrorism, counterinsurgency stuff. I mean, you know, as this hollow state is only good at one thing is, you know, hammering down nails and projecting this image of hypernormality. And then you have the corporations getting censorship and disconnection down to the individual level. They can watch every conversation that's occurring online. They can censor you at that level. Plus, all the AIs that are being built on that to nudge everybody and watch everything in real time. It's a pretty one-sided battle at this point.
It is. And so it's actually becoming quite dangerous to become one of these 75 million or so perceived deplorables. I mean, it could get nasty for them.
Right. That's if you're an anti-vaxxer, it's dangerous for you. If you're somebody who's like a anti-round worlders, you know, flat earthers, there's some. It's dangerous for you because you could be targeted and disconnected for even something as innocuous as that. I call this future that I wrote a report a couple of years ago. My worry is the consensus function, if it gets the stronger side in this battle between consensus and dissent, is that consensus in a network world can become total. It can become locked in through AIs and locked in through this corporate control of our conversations and our dialogues. And we're headed towards that. This is a long night. Is a civilization killer. I mean, it creates a very narrow orthodoxy of what's allowed and what can be talked about, and how the world should be seen, and what is a fact and what is not a fact has to comply, and anything else is screened out. It's totally wiped out, and if you push it, you're disconnected, and that kind of future is in our foreground right now. We're barreling towards it. If you get violent on the far side of that, you'll get hit by the counterterrorism, counterinsurgency group. If you try to even talk about it, you get hit by the corporate disconnection, unpersoning. It's a very dangerous future, and I don't see many people saying anything about it. They're, for the most part, they're kind of cheering on the idea that they'll go after the people that were at the Capitol event. It's a scary, scary world.
So what?
Something interesting is that, a lot of people say, you got Bitcoin, you got alternative texts, and as much as I love those alternative texts, and I was like in the global guerrillas kind of framework, alternative texts are great, for hot insurgencies, for small group communication and the like. But they're not viable alternatives for easy to disconnect. You have Janet Yellen just talking about Bitcoin being mostly used for terrorist financing and the like, and that she's going to come after it as Treasury Secretary. And that you know, what we saw with the big platforms is that they can line up every single big platform at once to disconnect something. And if they do that at the protocol level, and they do it at the hosting level for Bitcoin, it's gone. It just it becomes just something that Iran is using. And it's not really that much useful if you can't connect to it or conduct a transaction. And even they are starting to crack down on the electricity use there because of blackouts. So alternative tech is great for small stuff. It's not like I think we have to figure out a way to fight for control of the platform. And the only way I can see right now to do that is to have a digital bill of rights. And if anything that Republicans become, or anything that the right becomes, it pushes one thing, is this digital bill of rights that's forced on the corporations. That forces them to define the limits of free speech, which are should be only if you're threatening somebody directly with physical violence, and you can be disconnected. And that disconnection, if you're a known person with an identity, it's not permanent. Has a short period of time, you're like put in digital jail for a short period of time. The details of which, how this would work is, yet to be hashed out, but we need a digital bill of rights to constrain the companies and keep this platform open so it doesn't just, the gates don't close immediately and there's no alternative but the long night. Because alternative tech is great, but it's not gonna save us from this thing wearing it down the tracks. And, here's something interesting is that one of the things I saw with the corporations is they're looking for legitimacy. They're looking for some kind of street level legitimacy. They got some of that by going after and disconnecting Trump after the Capitol event. And, they've caught a kind of a bargain with the politicians in Washington by saying, okay, well, we'll protect you. We'll protect you from all the Trump movement at the right. If you leave us alone, and they're willing to do that. Anyone who tries to, in the political world, tries to attack them directly will end up like Elizabeth Warren when she attacked him. She just got tagged in it. All it takes is a couple algorithmic tweaks to the communication structure, and that politician dies. There's no way you can be elected if they're against you, unless you're overwhelmingly the favorite. They are also looking at trying to cut a deal with the tribal left, mostly the anti-racist, anti-colonials. A lot of their employees are already in the tribal left, and it creates something. With the hollowing out of the nation state, the whole idea of return of socialism is probably where they raise taxes to grow the bureaucracy to do things is pretty remote. It's very unlikely to happen. And that even Europe is trying to find ways to get out of it, but it's proving unable to do it. What we'll see, though, is something, a variant of that, is I call it personal socialism. It's kind of a coerced altruism, but focused on the individual, and that the corporations allying with the tribal left will force individuals to give up extra, change their behavior, or face censure. So if you have an environmental goal, if you have a diversity goal in your corporation, you have a choice to make on hiring and opportunity. Who do you give the opportunity to? That will be pushed. It's a costless thing for these companies and these oligarchs. They don't, won't cost them anything. It's not like taxes being raised to fund socialist programs or big national programs at the using a government. They can implement this stuff, gain street level legitimacy with millions. And it costs them nothing to implement. And it becomes part of this framework, this long night. It's just part of this narrow view of looking at the world. It's, your behavior should be this, because that's the way you should be contributing to the system. And everyone becomes more more similar over time. So I'm just tossing that out there. It's a big idea, but all the costs are borne by the individual. It's not borne by the population as a whole.
All right, folks, on that cheery note, we don't have time to play all of that, but if you're interested in that, you can find that. It's Doug Casey's Take, and the gentleman's name is John Robb. The Long Night. Presumably The Long Night is maybe an article he wrote, or maybe a book he wrote. But yeah, doesn't exactly paint a positive pictures for the likes of your host here or my listeners. But you never know what can happen. You know, there could be something unknown that comes into the equation that could change things. But yeah, it is stacked against us, the consensus against the dissenters, as many as even though there's a lot of us, they've sewn up the institutions, technology, you know, the social media, the corporations, government completely right now. So they're precarious times, but anyway, we soldier on. I'll be back next week, same time, 8 p.m. here, live from London. That will be what is the 4th, I think, February, something like that, next Wednesday. Until then, folks, take care and God bless.